Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Essential Craftsman podcast. I'm your host, Nate. We've got a pretty fun discussion for you today. It really is a discussion, not a lot of planning or forethought went into this. We've got Phil Rokas back. Phil did the plumbing on our spec house job. You've seen him here and there. He's really a great guy. He's been running a small plumbing business for a long time, and he grew up in a plumbing family. The conversation primarily centers around being a small contractor, working with customers, and competing and staying in business as a tradesman. Obviously, my dad knows a thing or two about that, and he's a part of this conversation as well. We move later in the conversation to a little bit of Phil's background. He was a machinist. He worked in some sawmills. Towards the end of the conversation, we return to talking about being a contractor with the focus on whether or not a young plumber or tradesman should pursue working for themselves as opposed to working for a company. So I hope you enjoy it. It's relatively casual, and you could imagine yourself just having lunch with these guys, and this is probably about the same type of conversation that they would be having. I hope you enjoy it. How come you don't want to have advertising public in this way? Is it advertising in general, or is it something about...
In general. Okay, let's do this. I get 10 calls today, and I can only do physically 3 of them. Now I got 7 mortal enemies that will never call me back again because I didn't hop right on them.
Yeah, he's afraid he'll get 20 calls.
And when the phone doesn't ring, I might be able to fix my leaky roof that's been leaking for 3 years.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So you don't want more jobs.
No,
in other words.
No, I can't keep up with. I could, but I just don't want to keep up. I'm old. If I had a crew to keep busy, I'd be all over this type of thing. I'd want to advertise because just to keep everybody working.
Yeah. Do you have any interest in like building a crew and sort of growing your business in that way?
Not yet, but I'm getting so old. I might think about it.
Yeah.
But you can't find anybody that's qualified. I mean, if I were to hire somebody, why don't they just do it themselves if they know that much that I would want to hire them? And it's just so simple if it's just me to take care of.
Yeah. Well, I know there are people who don't want to deal with the headaches you're describing. They want to leave work and be done with it. Although maybe for a plumber, that just plain never happens anyways, because if your boss calls you with an emergency job, maybe you really can't even get off the clock even when you're an employee. I don't know.
It depends on your personal etiquette, probably.
Yeah.
When the phone rings, I answer it. Rather than tell them I can't touch it or not, at least I'll talk to you. And I'll answer it Saturday afternoon, even Sunday afternoon, or Thanksgiving morning. And I know that I can't come and help you. I'll throw some sympathy at you.
Yeah.
And it's hard. And you never quit. I never quit. I'm on call all the time, every minute of the day.
So a problem I have is that people ask me, well, do you have a name to refer me to? And I don't. But you've got 2 or 3 guys that you'll give them their phone number, even if you know they will not be able to respond. At least you have a number to give them. Yes?
I used to throw work around here and there. Then I was in a grocery store one time, and this lady comes up and was crying, why did you send that guy to my house?
Oh.
That's the tip of the iceberg. Another lady, 20 yards away, comes screaming down the aisle and chimed in, don't you ever send that guy to my house.
At the same trip, at the
same
time?
Grocery store, 2 ladies screaming at me. And so after that, I go, I can't really recommend anybody because it always bites me every time I do.
Yeah.
And your best bet is just to call every one of them up.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of them that I will recommend, but they're busier than I am.
Okay.
So it just throws another problem onto...
So you
onto
got,
the,
you
those
know,
guys.
What was it, 5 years ago that Mike stepped into the game again? Has he been at it 5 years?
Probably.
So that's helped a little bit.
Yeah, but he's always so busy.
He's busy, the same thing.
So,
send him to his brother.
A lot of the problem is the people I used to throw work to got wise to me because if Phil doesn't want to do it, why would I? You know, it's always some horrible, cruddy job under a house or something.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And then there's a couple plumbers in town that I will recommend out, but I do it in a light way. It's not, I don't endorse them, but this guy will answer his phone.
Yeah.
And he's not going to screw you over.
Yeah. Not a bad guy.
Right.
So I know a lot of guys would be listening and say something like, well, you need to raise your prices to push the work off. But it's not that easy as a plumber because you don't have like a menu where people can buy what they know at the agreed upon price. So how does that kind of interact with all of this in terms of, you know, people's expectations about what you're going to bill them? Anyways, maybe you crowd them in and it's totally inconvenient. Can you make it worth your while?
Ask me how much I cost until I give them the bill. And I call up everybody every year or so to see who's the highest guy in town and jack it up $10.
Huh. Like, what is that? Like a per hour?
Per hour, per call. The first hour is charged. Then we break it into half hours.
Okay.
So I may be more, one guy might be $80 an hour. And let's say I'm $100 an hour. If I'm only there for 10 minutes, I'm not always going to charge this person for that whole hour, especially if it's, I come in there and the chain's off the flapper. I'll just leave and shake their hand and say, call me next time.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm out there digging everybody for money.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it makes it worth it to go, and you're not competing with everybody. And like I say, no one's ever asked how much I charge. And when they do, it's someone that's on a tight budget and they're shopping. They have to because they don't have any money. And so, often I'm so busy anyway, and generally most of my work comes from the people I already know or my friends' friends. And then you're really committed. You can't say no to your friends.
Yeah, people think that it's somehow a substitute for a credit research department to work. You know, so big businesses have people that research the credit of their clients and likelihood of pay and handle contracts that big contractors do. Little guys like you and I don't have that. And so I, for a long time, thought, well, if I only work for people that where we have a mutual acquaintance, then I'm protected because since we both know somebody, they're going to pay me. Well, that's kind of right, but it also works against you because now I have even more skin in the game because if anything goes bad in this thing, it jeopardizes not just my relationship with this new person, but my relationship with this other person that referred them because they know me. And so everybody is kind of double obligated, which I guess is what everybody's counting on, but it can be pretty dicey.
And a lot of companies will schedule service work, so they got to keep a calendar full. And I don't even have a schedule, a little bit of one, but it changes so drastically. You go to a job, you thought, well, that'll take an hour, and it takes four. What happens to the other scheduled events all down the road? Yeah. It ruins everything. So I don't really keep a hard schedule. I just tell everybody that I'm really busy this week, and it'd be a week if you can wait that long. And after I get rid of my first five or six scheduled events, I start scheduling more, but I can't schedule a month ahead because it just snowballs into a catastrophe.
I know like hairstylists as an example have this problem where their friends, speaking of friends and family, where their friends and family call them, hey, can you cut my hair? Just because they're your friends, it takes 10 minutes, or cut my kid's hair for me. And man, it's like so hard for them to bill. It's not hard for them to bill, but there's like this expectation of, oh, I thought we're friends.
Yeah.
Does that happen with plumbing? Like people like ask you to put a water heater in?
Oh, yeah.
I thought we were friends.
It'll only take you an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you see me squirming, it's because I've beat him up this way before. And I got a little problem, Phil. It won't take you over a week.
And no worries. I don't need a permit.
Yeah.
Well, I need a permit. I don't care about you. And poor Scott.
Yeah,
I work him so bad. Every job I felt bad. And this brings me to the point of we do electricians and plumbers and the trades guys that are theoretically skilled charge so much for so little of what they do compared to what Scott built a whole house. Right. And if you broke it down, he makes 88 cents an hour.
Well, there is that.
We do a remodel and I'm there 3 hours, two different days and get a grand.
Yeah.
And Scott's there for a week, and his whole profit is a grand.
Yeah, but here is why it was so sweet, is because Phil, the first time I used Phil on a remodel, and he came in, and so a contractor is nervous about a plumbing repair, particularly in a remodel where you're in a kitchen or in somebody's house and in and out. And by about the end of the first 20 minutes, these people were smiling and nodding and just comfortable with this guy. There's something about the way you relate to these people that made them... they were a little appalled at how much it was costing, but they were just having such a good time interacting that they just relaxed. And I tell you what, that boosted my rate from 88 cents an hour to about 98.50, you know. yeah, a buck.
Yeah, I scare people off that use me for the first time. I often never work for them because
of how you bill.
No, because the way I explain how this job's going to go.
Oh, yeah. And you kind of tell them what they're in for.
You know, if you meet a person and if you talk to them for the first 5 minutes and you've only talked to them for 5 minutes in your whole life, and the first thing that comes out of their mouth is, how much did you budget? And they say $2,000. Well, triple that and it'll be more.
That's what I'm talking about.
And
and they immediately, they don't know whether to laugh or cry, but the ones that roll with it, they're just relaxed from there on out.
I'm usually there saying that, representing a contractor that's trying to get a price.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just green. Yeah. You know, like, oh, what is he doing on my job?
How often do you leave a interview or a proposal like that and decide you're not taking the job or you don't want to work with that person? Does that even happen, or do you kind of feel an obligation no matter what?
Yeah, you can have a sense about them, especially when they're nickel and diming everything you're looking at. And like that first comment, you triple it and we'll be fine. And if they don't have a problem with that, you know the job might go smooth. It never does.
Yeah.
There are people that you hear about too in town. So, you know, in the trades, people don't know that a lot of the tradesmen visit with each other and have lunch. Mm-hmm. And it's like, watch out for this one because they had trouble getting paid.
Oh, about the customer.
Yeah.
Got it.
And so you go into those people knowing that, and can you wait 4 months?
Yeah.
You know, don't be mean.
I'd love to do this, but I can't get here until next fall.
Yeah, right. And then they call you next fall.
Yeah, that's a problem.
That's the problem.
That's the problem.
In a big city, it's not that way because there's so many plumbers and there's so many customers that there probably are just both customers. And, of course, shoe on the other foot, there's terrible contractors as well. But there's probably customers who just burn through a contractor and torch them and don't even bat an eye and move on to the next one knowing they're going to squeeze every
customers.
Drop out
I
of
just
them.
Had a call, actually, the other night from a plumber in town that got ripped pretty bad by a gal who knows contract language and contract law. So he did a whole bunch of work out there and then cried about it and said she's not paying the bill and then called the CCB before anything. And the CCB is not on our side.
That's
on the
Construction Contractors Board.
They are on the consumer's side.
Every time.
We're the problem.
We are the problem.
Well, that's the reason they exist, is to protect the general public from
us.
You.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I've seen where they've helped a lot from SCAB contractors, of course, but I've been in situations where we've had a arbitration over frivolous baloney, and they're not helping us a bit. No. All they can do is to get us to pay them to get out of there. They're encouraging us just to pay her off.
Yeah.
Get out of there.
What happened with that lady? She dug through the contract and basically...
Well, we had a written contract and we weren't liable for nothing, but we had to go to litigation and waste time.
Yeah.
Okay, but we had two things going. The plumber that you were talking to who got ripped by a lady.
No,
she knew language.
They told him to pay her and walk on.
Yeah.
Wow.
So and that brings me to a strange question. Is that collusion when all the contractors warn everybody about somebody that's ruined them? It's so that you avoid them? I mean,
collusion's not a crime, is it? I mean, you're allowed to talk and
everything I do.
Share information. Collusion's kind of a naughty word right now. So
I don't know what collusion even means, but I know I've appreciated once or twice. I had one client give me the name of the woman that he had just recommended that she call me. And he said, and he used her name. I'll say that her name was Susie. And Susie warning. And he had my attention. Okay, well, I was foolish enough to not really listen to his Susie warning. And about halfway through the job, which really went, it was the only job I ever had that really went sideways. I gave her $15,000 to get away from her and get off the job and leave. But about 2/3 of the way through there, I was in my paint supplying, my paint suppliers, ColorCraft, great store in Roseburg. And I was talking about where I was at, and they saw the address or something, and they said, is that such and such? Is that Susie's place? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, you do have your hands full. Mm-hmm. And so her reputation was everywhere, but that didn't stop me from signing the contract and jumping in. And so I'm thankful for that part of a small town. If you do a good job, a small town provides your advertising for you. Mm-hmm. And if you take advantage of that, it'll also provide your credit research.
Yeah, when this town was tiny, when we were little kids, mm-hmm. Dad would drill that into us. Mm-hmm. You do something right, no one will know at all. Do something wrong, and everybody in town's going to know about
it. Everybody's going to know it.
And now the town's so big that I even heard a comment from a plumber saying, I'll never run out of customers.
Yeah.
Which means I do what I want with them. I'm not going to run out of them.
Yeah. There's always be somebody calling again.
Horrible. Yeah. They're the profiteers.
Yeah. Well, so it's easy to see how a shady contractor could take advantage of people in the same way a bad customer can take advantage of probably almost any contractor if they decide to. Can a tradesman really make money as a solo lone wolf kind of a guy? Or is it, how does that work? Because it sounds just so busy and you get chewed out for billing high. And
being
how does
busy
work?
Doesn't mean you're billing every hour or minute of the day. Yeah. You'd be awfully darn busy. Plus, you got to go back and correct things that didn't go perfectly. Guaranteeing your work mm-hmm. will eat up a little bit of time. Not a big deal, but a lot of it is not having an overhead.
Yeah.
When you start off, you're buying trucks and vans and tools. And when you're at the end of the deal, you own everything and you're not, the overhead is cut way, way down.
Yeah.
So if you start out a business and you're renting a shop and you're leasing your trucks and this and that, is going to eat into how much money you can take home.
Yeah.
And then what you do with the money you take home.
Yeah.
Don't just blow it and invest it. You'll go somewhere.
Yeah.
The deal is, it's not always the tradesman. It's the businessman and the tradesman that makes them successful. Not that they're smarter than the other guy.
Yeah.
They know how to use the money right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and there's a difference between enjoying and understanding business and enjoying and understanding your trade. And the two don't always, ideally you would have a talent for both. But most of us have one or the other. At least that's my experience.
Yeah.
Have you met tradesmen who are really skilled tradesmen and also really good at running their lone wolf or even a small?
Just Scott.
Yeah, not much of a businessman.
Not really. And usually the tradesman that's good at his trade has a babysitter that does the business.
Yeah. Yeah.
My bookkeeper is my babysitter. She keeps me from moving to Mexico.
Yeah.
And keeps track of everything, so I don't have to worry about that. You spend just as much, you can go to work all day long and come home until 10 o'clock at night and getting the books straight and keeping everything in order. So I have a person that I give money to that does that for me.
Yeah.
So that speaks to the myth that solo contractors have lower overhead. They absolutely don't. I used to think that. I used to think that because I was just myself and one guy or myself and my subs, that my overhead was lower than you know, pick a big Noah, you know. That is nonsense because it devours at least half of a small contractor's time just staying in business. And then if half your time is available to produce billable hours, that means that 50% of your effort is donated to overhead. Mm-hmm. And I do not think the big contractors, that 50% of their effort is consumed with supporting the office staff.
Right.
Yeah, the whole division of labor applies on grand scales and small scales, and even inside a business, like your highest and best use is going to be doing the work, but interacting exactly with the customers, and then everything else, the bookkeeping and the picking up parts and supplies, is probably not the highest and most valuable thing you know how to do, I guess. But a big contractor can do that. They can get a delivery guy for minimum wage to just zip parts around, but. That's hard to do for most of us.
And, you know, we have to abuse our wives.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, by the way, honey, take care of this. Oh, by the way, take care of that.
Oh, yeah, please.
Yeah. And regulatory compliance. You know, we think, wow, I'm sure glad I'm not a big corporation. Roseburg Lumber, okay, with their the environmental stuff. And, boy, I'm sure glad I don't have to comply with that. Well, actually, they've probably got, I don't know, 40 people out of 4,500 people who handle all that. That is a teeny percentage of their labor effort that's gone for regulatory compliance.
Yeah.
But at least as a small general contractor, regulatory compliance is a big thing between getting the plans ready to apply for the permit and pay for the permit and call for the inspections and be there when the inspector's there and then go back. And so a big chunk of the small players carry a bigger burden as a percentage.
And that's why somebody that's working for you, an apprentice that just turned out, goes out all day and pumps out work and delivers the bills, the tickets, and sees, well, you know, $1,000 just came in for me. And then he goes out on his own and realizes that he can only spend a quarter of that time doing what he did before and still has to babysit the rigs and everything else.
But on the other hand, the freedom is worth something.
It's
worth something, because neither you nor I would be happy for more than about 20 minutes working for somebody else.
I've worked for other people, and the only person I've worked for that I actually worked was my best friend, and he had a machine shop, and I worked in his machine shop with him. And it's kind of like working with you. It was all, you know, word of mouth with I'll do this, and yes, I'll do that. But yeah, waking up, and I worked in a mill as a millwright, and I'd show up, and I'd chase whistles. That means when two whistles blew, I had to run to an area and fix something.
So explain a millwright. That's like a common trade
around
here.
It's a maintenance at a mill, a guy that just fixes stuff.
But it's not maintenance the way like a facility maintenance. It's like you're repairing the sawmill itself.
The sawmill, as it's running, is alive. And when it dies because something doesn't work, everybody goes home and a whole bunch of money goes down the drain. So the millwright fixes it before they have to send everybody home, hopefully.
So it's the maintenance on the machines and the capital equipment.
You go weld something that fell off on even temporarily to keep the mill running until you can fix it when everybody goes home at night.
So do mills generally have a machine shop on site so they can make and repair parts and
stuff? I went to work in the machine shop at the mill, and then they made me go chase whistles to fix it too when I wasn't cutting metal. So you show up at work and you had to sign in. And if you signed in late, you lose your production bonus. And we had great big ones. So $800 every 2 weeks for a production bonus.
That's a lot.
So it was worth it. And so I'd pull in, and they'd have some emergency going on. They'd send me out there to fix it before I clocked in. And then I'd lose my bonus. And so now you're dealing with bureaucracy that is unbending. And then you lose your will to help. And that's what happens all the time. You get a fresh guy in there, and he'll jump all up and down through hoops to do it. And then you see the older guys, and they look at you doing that like you're an idiot.
You're naive, son. You don't know what's really going on
But it was great fun. I had a great time playing that game.
So you would do all kinds of stuff there. You would handle steam. You would handle welding and kind of wire with a MIG gun. You would put a machine back together to keep it going until in between shifts. You would handle electrical problems as they surfaced. You would handle
everything.
Machine problems as they surfaced.
We weren't supposed to touch electricity. You had to be a licensed electrician. You know, but, you know, sometimes you did it.
So cars and normal things that normal people repair, it's kind of intuitive and model specific. You can find help. But on a sawmill, are those kind of like is it kind of its own animal at that point? Or is it even still like this mill was made by so-and-so and you can contact the manufacturer? Or is it pretty much just talk to the oldest guy on crew because he's the one who knows?
It's all such simple tinker toys. You stare at it and there's a pillow block bearing and a shaft running through it, spinning a sprocket, pulling a chain of wood around.
But it is all Frankenstein. It's some of this and
Well, there's some nice stuff. Like there's a sawmills with templesonic cylinders that are run by a computer. And the computer knows where the cylinder is in space. You know, So a saw will saw a certain size board, its width, real accurately. So you'd have to null that machine and get everything zeroed out on it before the shift started. So there was some technical stuff.
But a lot of it, when something broke, it was relatively clear, like here's the bearing or here's the part.
Yeah, and the thing's just a shaken mess, so everything broke. So you always worked on, let's not have to fix this all the time. So you'd try to invent a way to cushion something that's shaking real bad. So you're always playing that invention game there a little bit.
But that was because that mill had that production bonus.
Yeah.
Most of these mills don't have that.
No, you show up by the hour,
and if it breaks, it breaks. Nobody cares.
Right. And that production bonus was scary. Mafia City. Well, I shouldn't say Mafia City, but let's say somebody screwed up and everybody lost their bonus because the mill shut down because somebody threw a picaroon into a chipper. Okay. They got thrown in a gunny sack and beat up.
It was serious.
They thump them. They wouldn't normally be so you know, physical about it, but they gave him such a bad time they'd quit.
Yeah, just drive off.
It was no fun to go to work.
Get rid of that kid. So we can be open. This was in Glide. This was Glide Lumber.
Yeah,
and WTD was the entity, and I can say that because they are broke. They don't exist anymore. The mill was sold to Seneca, I think.
Yeah, Swanson.
Then Swanson closed it up. I think they bought it for the.
They moved to Sun Studs.
Yeah.
So my whole crew from Suns is down at Sun Studs now.
Yeah,
all the millwrights I worked with, and they'll call me because the toilet's plugged up. Just so they can come and visit.
There, clean the toilet.
Yeah, and they'll make sure it's some horrifying thing that they won't bother calling.
But they don't get no production bonus anymore.
No. And yeah, the guys were also old. They're in overalls and the collars are pressed, and there's not a bit of grease on them. Yeah. I laugh.
So your point is that the production bonus was valuable for the mill because they put out more timber and lumber.
Nobody cut studs like Glide Lumber did for a while. Nobody. I don't know if anybody ever has. Do you remember the production like? 320,000 board feet of studs in an 8-hour shift, something like that.
I don't know, but there was huge pride in.
Yes.
And people just wanted to get down.
Because everybody's like, either the whole mill got the bonus or nobody got
it.
Yeah. Yeah. But nobody could crank out studs in the world. Nobody on the planet could make studs like Glide Lumber when they were hammering.
But there were some truly talented people there too.
Yeah. Bob Talbert helped design that. He was a smart old boy. He's in bad shape now.
And there's another brother mill to that up in Tillamook that's the same copy that never did half the production.
Interesting.
Because of the people there. Yeah. You know?
So do you think that the mill shut down? So it changed ownership. They removed the production bonus. And are you thinking that's what led to them?
There's no logs to cut.
Yeah, it was cyclical. It was commodity. It was commodity ups and downs. And the spotted owl came in. And so the timber source, which was up the North Umpqua, so at Glide, they were they were close to the source,
right?
Okay, like mills always were. And then that timber source dried up there. So now they were being trucked from everywhere else up to Glide. So transportation costs went up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was just cyclical and it was changing. Oh, part of it was WTD went public. Okay, they did an IPO. They did a stock offering and people bought in. Local people bought in because they knew how much money was going on there. And then... somewhat predictably, the IPO went good for the people that sold the stock and bad for the people that bought it.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things.
Well, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Because they studs are still made right here. There's still stud mills around here that are in business. Not like studs went out of business,
no.
Right?
Wait, IPO, is that the right phrase?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. But yeah, no, Douglas County Lumber now kind of occupies that niche.
They have an advantage. They're like right on rail tracks and on I-5.
Yep.
So it was...
they're automated.
Yeah, so tough for Glide to compete with the mill that has those, you know,
advantages. Yeah, but Glide died about the time Douglas County Lumber began to really get efficient.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people moved over there.
What happened to the mill, the saw mill machinery itself? Do you know where that went, the mill you worked on?
A lot of it went to Sun Studs, which is it's called something else now. Swanson Group.
Yeah,
Swanson.
So all those millwrights but just unbolted the machine and brought it over there and put it back together?
Yeah, some of these guys build a swing saw that cuts off the log to length.
Yeah.
It's the first thing the log sees.
Yeah.
And it is a really nifty saw. And they, you know, these guys, this is their baby. You know, they made that in the shop and it is trick. And so they torched that thing off its base and packed it home.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they just went and brought anything of value down to the other mill and stored it and retroed it in through the time.
So the next time we drive up there, well, look, there's still logs in the deck, you know, kind of junk logs. I think they were some wildlife logs or something, but now it's 20 years old.
And it's pretty scabbed away now, but there's nothing there. I was up there and every bit of equipment is gone. That's there's skeleton of the place.
Yeah. Is that kind of what moved you from machining into plumbing? Is that kind of the moment where you are now like needing a new job because that mill is gone and transitioned?
I was working at a machine shop with my best friend I was talking about. And then I moved on and worked at Ramey Loaders and built log loaders and stuff just for money, to make a living. I never wanted to be a plumber. That was the last thing I wanted to do. And then I went up millwrighted, still just making wages to see what else I'm going to do here in life. And I still work with my buddy, and he has a vacuum forming company that sucks plastic over mold. So I built all the molds, you know. Mm. So after I got them all up and going, pretty much they didn't really need me. So anyway, we still go back and forth a little bit.
Yeah.
And then my dad retired and said, I'm going to dump it if you or you can have it. Well, then I got to thinking, all this millwright and I'm getting old and this is hard. And
yeah.
And so I went back to plumbing. So I had to go back and take my plumbing test again.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun.
Well, so, but now we mentioned freedom. You have more freedom. Any self-employed
guy,
especially trade. How do you think about that compared to your
golden,
punch on the clock?
That's it. That makes up for making $1 million a year.
Yeah,
it does. When you had to wake up and be on site and your car's not running right or this and that, and there's all this stress to be there, and you're dominated your life. You cannot plan nothing. I can't now. Anyway, but I think I can.
At least you know it's your own fault.
That's right. And if I wake up and have a cup of coffee and want to look at something on the internet, and I don't have to be, you know, I can just get my thoughts together and go to work.
Yeah.
At my leisure.
But we got to throw this out there for the young guys that are listening to this and thinking, I want that. That freedom is valuable, but it is expensive.
Oh,
freedom is expensive, and it costs, and it costs, and it costs.
Oh, yeah.
And so then the calculation is it worth it?
What do you mean it costs? I mean, what are you referring to?
That I'm referring to stress. I'm referring to the peaks and valleys aspect of of tradesman job income. It's either more work and so more money than you need and can reasonably spend, or absolute starvation, particularly when you're starting up. Where there's you want to work, you have the ability to work, and there is no work.
Yeah.
And that's about the worst feeling that there is.
And it happens because of the economic climate.
Yep.
Even though you might be doing great, and then it just kind of, all your savings kind of slopes away because there's not a lot of work. And then when you do have a lot of money, or, you know, you feel comfortable, you're not hungry anymore.
Yeah.
And you get lackadaisical.
Yeah.
And then... anyway, there's just, you think and worry about it all the time. If you had to be on a job at 8 a.m, you're just a zombie as far as having to worry. I mean, you still have to worry because you don't make enough money no matter where you work. Yeah. So you're always needing money.
Yeah.
Whereas what we do, if we really work harder, we'll make more money.
Yeah.
If you're at your job 8 to 5, no matter how hard you work, really.
But we're old enough now to look at guys who made that choice. You know, the guys that worked for UPS for 35 years, or the guys that, or, you know, fill in the blank at that mindless, repetitive thing that I would kill myself if I would have had to do that. But then they get to this age.
And they got retirement.
There's a retirement that actually lets them sunset in a fairly comfortable way. So, I mean, it is a trade-off.
That's
for
the point of being smart before you start.
If you can.
A lot of times you just work and work just to keep ends met without planning for retirement, or you just don't have the funds to put into retirement. Mm-hmm. You save up some money thinking, I'll throw this in an IRA, and then some lady sues you for nothing,
or the truck
blows up, or some freaks come and steal everything out of your shop.
That's right. Yeah. You had that. Talk about that.
Hang on one sec, because there are also guys who work for FedEx or some company who are also fired.
Yes.
5 years before the retirement.
That's right.
So the any confidence that you have in that is also a little bit, nothing is certain at all. And I think
security.
It's becoming less certain over time. I mean, 30 years ago, that was conventional wisdom. I don't know if that's really conventional wisdom right now, that you can be with one company for 45 years and get a retirement. Maybe it is. I don't know.
It's not near as likely.
Yeah.
Most companies aren't their own company for 45 years. They
get
bought
too.
And sold 45 times.
That's the talking to risk of if a person is trying to decide. Another component to that is if you start down that path, it can be a one-way road, because after 4 or 5 years, your expertise, well, it was for you, a machining, I'm sure you could get hired in a machine shop. But for some guys, you get away from your desk job, and all of a sudden, even if you have a college degree like I do, it's totally obsolete. People would laugh at me. It's nothing. And you go down this one road, it can be tougher to jump back in and, you know, make the move back.
Being a machinist now, you're not going to make nothing compared to a plumber.
Okay. Well,
A machinist now is not the same as back in the day.
Well, why is that? Just computerized machines?
It's all computerized. And when I started off machining, there was the first CNC computerized machines in the shop. We thought, oh, those are really neat, but what's going to happen to machinists? Because I worked with these old-time machinists from Czechoslovakia. And they would drill in the techniques to me, and I thought to myself, this took 50 years for them to learn it, and they're 60.
Yeah.
and they barely know how are we ever going to get machinists if these electric machines are doing it all? And now they've taken over, and they're far better than any aerospace machinist was in the 60s.
Yeah.
And they and those boys did phenomenal things.
But the machinists are out of jobs now, right? There's less machinists.
There's no such thing as a CNC programmer.
Yeah.
So there's job shops that fix stuff, like around mills and stuff, like A-Bomb. He's my hero.
Yeah, so, he's the man.
That's a machinist. Now there's programmers.
I see. Oh, okay.
The program knows how fast the tool has to spin and how fast it can move along, you know, what material you're cutting, and yada, yada. You know,
And the programmer is more of a software job where you're like, you're looking at the input on the screen and making sure it's...
Hardly ever even get in front of the machine. They got some monkey there changing parts out.
Yeah.
You know, they put a piece of stock in and push a button and shut the lid. And they sit in an office and they can look out over everybody, you know, and punch numbers into a computer.
So all this being said, for both of you, I mean, would you recommend a young, skilled tradesman who's been in it for 5 years, who's less than 30 years old, would you tell that guy to go off on his own? Let's say, since we're talking about plumbers, let's stick with plumbers.
Well, the mindset has to be there. You have to be a businessman and a skilled craftsman.
Yeah.
And you need to be a little bit of a people person.
Yeah.
Or you only work for somebody once.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those soft skills are so important.
So important.
Yeah. And dad was a schmoozer.
Yeah.
He taught us how.
Your dad's pretty smooth, man.
Oh, yeah. And he would treat ladies like ladies, open the door for them. When we come up to a customer's house, they open the door, and we were taught this. We wait till they open the door and they can see us, and then we take our shoes off in front of them.
Yeah.
And we have brand new nice socks on, mm-hmm. and walk in their house. And they'll say, oh, you don't have to do that. And oh, no, you don't know where these have been. And
Phil, your dad was really good at it. But let me just say this. As much as I admire your dad, you have taken it not to a higher level, but to a better place. I mean, the way you interact with the clients that I've taken you to, I
do that crap more or less just so I can get a feel for the customer.
Yes, you do.
Because
yes, you do.
If they look at me all appalled and they're like disgusted with my whole being in their house,
then you know
I'm not going to work for it. I'm not going to work here. And yep. And I'll always present the horror story. And at the end of the day, it comes in nicer.
Yeah, that's it.
So if you present a lovely day and then it just tear the wall out, then it's a surprise. It's just bad.
You're all about under-promising and over-delivering. Man, that's a great recipe.
That helps.
What are some of the other, not just jokes, but tools you use to sort of feel your customer out? You already said you take their estimate and triple it.
Oh, let me tell you.
Some of the other techniques you use
share one of the things that he does that always works so beautifully towards the end of the job. Because sometimes towards the end of the job, I mean, it's been a long day and the customer's kind of tired and the plumber's about done and they're anxious how long he's been there. And he'll get into the sink and he'll say, oh, that's not leaking yet. Weird. Okay. and they go, ah, and then is he being funny? But he's under there looking, and it just disarms him completely. Mm. And he's checked it for leaks, and he's let him know, okay, call me right away because this is going to leak before I get down to the end of the street. Yeah. You know, stuff like that. It works really well.
It's so bad that if a week later on a brand new install, you got a drip under your kitchen sink and it's ruined the bottom of the cabinet and blistered the paint off. So sometimes I'll say, now listen, ma'am, everything I touch leaks. But I want you to look under there tomorrow. And they'll either laugh or give you the look of, what are you doing in my house?
Yeah, give a stink eye.
Yeah.
But they will check the bottom of the cabinet.
And I'll explain to them why I said that too afterwards. I go, listen, let's just not repair your cabinet. Just keep an eye on it for a day or two. Be sure to call me.
See, that's a great service because the kid who's working for XYZ Plumbing's not going to say that, and the people will close the cabinet and they won't look in there until the bottom of the cabinet's wrecked. And so that's a great customer
and
service.
And they'll tighten up something that had a drip on it, and then walk off and don't give it just a 2 minutes, wait 2 minutes even, and touch it, see if it's, you know.
Yeah.
But I've had a few things where I've had to come back and buy a cabinet, and that taught me right there.
You bet. We learned. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what about you, Phil? You would encourage a kid to get into plumbing? That kid who's less than 30, been in plumbing, go out on your own if you have those soft skills? I mean,
it depends on if they're working for a company they like. We're in a little tiny town. There's a lot to choose from. But some of these larger towns have got nice outfits.
Yeah.
So with all kinds of benefits and, you know, insurance programs.
Yeah.
And if you can tolerate the environment, stay there and just get your retirement at the end of the day. You work so hard and not have a retirement at the end of the program, you'll be mad.
And then the other piece of that is, and we were talking about, you know, missing the exits on the freeway until you get to a point where you can't take an exit. That's not as true in the trades, because if you're working for people for a big, successful, and let's say human plumbing company, you are building your reputation while you're working for those people. Mm-hmm. You know, you're working with other subcontractors and other general contractors. And if you're a producer, if you have those soft skills, you've already caught people's eye. You have their attention. And if you ever need a job, or if you ever need to step out on your own, if you've been smart, if you've kept track of all the phone numbers, if you've been doing a little bit of espionage and keeping track of how many hours you work to put in this water heater and how many hours you work to do this service and getting an idea of what your actual productivity is, you have the information you need to start that business.
Yeah. There's a degree of patience that I would say these kids need to develop, all of us, but if you're learning new things and you're seeing new types of jobs, don't feel like you have, if you wait 5 or 10 more years, you can probably always, if you're in plumbing, let's say, make that move. And if it's a good company and you're paying your bills and you're still learning things, there's probably nothing wrong with staying put and absorbing as much of that as you
can. It's education. Now, the other thing about the trades, you're paid to learn. And so if you're learning and still being paid, why not ride it?
Yeah.
And if I was working for a big company in a larger city, I would learn how to plumb and do as much, you know, for a certain 10 years of time, and then just concentrate on how to run a plumbing company so you don't get dirty and don't break your back, and just run a bunch of kids around at the end. And that even goes towards starting your own company. Don't start a company to go plumbing. Start a company to hire 10 people.
Yeah.
But you have to know what you're doing first. And you're going to be 40 before that happens you start when you're 20.
That's right.
So you can't, you know, everybody wants to do everything right now. Yeah. It takes time.
I knew a guy who started a painting company later in his life. I think he was probably, I don't know if he was 50, but he was right up there. And it only took him like 5 or 10 years, and the painting company was massive. Dozens of trucks and crews and making real money. And he just worked for a lot of years before that, and bang, all of a sudden made that move. And I got to think he had been planning that for quite a while. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Was he in Arizona?
Yeah.
Big market. He knew where the opportunity was.
Yeah. Actually, I know two painters there, and they're both good examples. The one of them started painting when he was 19, and I think just maybe started on his own at 22 or 23, but just very slow and steady. And he has a huge outfit also. Mm-hmm. But the point is, it's easy when you're really young, and I'm still there to some extent, to feel impatient. Like, I need to have this success or this size business or these things kind of right now. And you see older guys who might be at that point, and it's hard to remember that they spent 20 or 25 years, you know, under the sink, you know, turning the nuts the same way that you're doing at the moment.
Yeah. So it's true.
Maybe the most important, while we're on it, and maybe you guys have had to lean on this, is the importance, if you're starting your own thing, to save money beforehand. And even probably while you're running your business, because like you said, industries can shift and maybe even go a month or two without a job. When you have a job, you get used to that paycheck. I can't remember what guy said something on Twitter. I saw the guy said something like, the most addictive thing in the world after heroin is a paycheck, something like that. So it is really important to have some savings, not because you need to invest in a million new trucks, but just so you can weather the storm if there's a period of time without work.
And you and I, neither one of us were very good at that for the first part of our lives for different reasons. But the times when there was money in the bank were vastly less stressful times.
And those were even scarier times because you lost your hunger.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And you thought everything was cool. Yeah. And then some unknown catastrophe happens and it all goes away, and then you're starving again and you get on it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. But the people, so that gets us back to somewhere close to where we started, that the different personalities that are, that we all have different priorities, right? And we do what we do for different reasons. And the people who are doing what they do in order to accumulate some security or some wealth or some asset, don't take their eye off that ball for some reason. They have the same fire in their belly, whether or not they have some or not. They have that same goal hanging out there in front of them, I guess.
Yeah, family is a big chunk of a goal, because you got to babysit a couple people now.
You do.
And
That's a constant catalyst.
And I always never did anything for the money, as far as I always wanted to make stuff.
Yep.
You know, or, you know, do things.
Do things. Do.
It wasn't about doing it to make the money. It's about doing it to do it.
To do it.
And then say you did it or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Or something.
Who knows? Like I said before, you figure that all out at the end.
At the
end. You know all about it. You're an expert.
So if a young guy goes into business, the first thing I would tell him, like right off the bat, is raise your price. Raise your price, because you go into business thinking that you can only charge what you would be willing to pay.
Yeah.
And that is a fundamental thinking error. Mm. And if you're only working for people who can afford to pay what you could afford to pay, you're working for the wrong people. You need to shift your targeted market.
Yeah.
You'd be working for
and
people.
And that will eventually change your mind as to how much money there is out there.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because there's people out there that could drop $50,000 on a kitchen counter without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And you're worried about saving them $5.
That's right. Or $50.
Or
$500.
Or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. You shift your emphasis from looking for a way to save people money to looking for a way to exceed their expectations.
Yeah.
And as soon as you start figuring out ways to exceed people's expectations, you begin to give yourself the authority to raise your prices, mm-hmm. and things get better. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's something you can learn, whether customers or anybody. And I hired a contractor once to do some fencing, and he made a comment about, I bought a new tool. I can't remember what it was. And I bought it used. Like, how much was that? And I was like, wow, I think I said it was like $200. And he reacted, wow, that is so expensive. Something like that. And it was kind of just like, I don't know, this is a normal price. But right away, I was like, wow, this guy really values $200 a lot. And sure enough, that whole job, every price was just great. You mm-hmm. could tell he really, mm-hmm. he was assuming that I looked at a dollar the same way he did.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we did to some extent, but other guys are a little more tuned, where they know, like, okay, this person could look at money completely from another universe the way I do. And I'd probably rather be in his universe than mine.
So those are the guys you want to hire.
Yeah,
but those are not the guys you want to work for.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. This has been a good conversation. The comments, if you have questions or feedback, leave it in the comments on YouTube, and we'll try to probably circle back to this, because it's just so different for every person, and that's the bottom line. If you're going to start your business, it has to be your way of doing it. You can't follow somebody else's formula exactly. What worked for one person will not exactly work for the other person. You just got to take what you like from different people's things and kind of assemble into something that would work for you.
And if it helps you understand, we're in a shop here where the temperature is what right now? 39 or 40? And my skinny old bones, I'm a little tense.
I'm hot.
You're high. Well, there is that resistance to heat transfer that happens. But anyhow, we're having a good time, and I hope that some of this is interesting or useful. It's good to have Phil with us. You know, one thing, Phil, when I was doing more remodels and additions, we got to play more often.
It was great fun.
Nice. It was great.
It was never
fun.
Going to work.
Yeah, it was never going to work. Yeah. So it's good to be able to connect here at a podcasting table, and we'll see you in the upstairs of the spec house here in a couple weeks.
That's right. We better finish that.
Anything you're nervous about or in terms of finishing the spec house, anything you're thinking about that's in your mind, whether it's the cameras or how the job's going to go or anything before it actually gets here that...
Well, sure. I don't have any idea if I put the pipes in the right place. We'll find out shortly.
We tore out some joists to make it work, okay?
I know. Probably in the wrong bay.
Yeah. It'll be great. Good deal. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll catch you next time.